On this June 28th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your Monday headlines. From Business Insider, there is this, quote, Mitch McConnell could blow up the bipartisan infrastructure deal after Biden reassured Senate Republicans. We will explain just ahead. Meanwhile, the highly contagious Delta variant rapidly spreading among unvaccinated Americans at a moment when the U.S. vaccination rates have stalled, particularly in the South. The CDC reporting that 54% of the total U.S. population is now fully vaccinated against coronavirus. But in southern states like Alabama, Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, among those with the lowest vaccination rates at or below 35%. A federal district judge dismissing the FTC antitrust complaint, alleging Facebook engaged in anti-competitive practices. And news from the White House that President Biden will not be attending the Summer Olympic Games in Tokyo. The delegation could be led by First Lady Jill Biden, but plans are still being drafted. The games, of course, were delayed a year because of COVID-19. Some of the stories shaping Washington Today. It's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. We begin with the very latest debate on the infrastructure bill, a proposal that is a centerpiece of the White House Democratic agenda this summer, with the two parties still trying to figure out a path forward. In one development today, the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell demanding that congressional Democrats separate a bipartisan infrastructure deal from a sweeping Democratic-only bill. In a statement issued by the Kentucky Republican, it reads as follows, quote, unless Leader Schumer and Speaker Pelosi walk back their threats that they will refuse to send the president a bipartisan infrastructure bill unless they also separately pass trillions of dollars for unrelated tax hikes, wasteful spending, and a Green New Deal socialism, then President Biden's walk back of the veto threat would be a hollow gesture, adding that the president cannot let congressional Democrats hold a bipartisan bill hostage over a separate and partisan process. That from the Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell. He also spoke about the latest plans between Democrats and Republicans in Louisville, Kentucky, earlier today.
10 of my members have been keeping me posted, and I've encouraged them to try to see if we could get an outcome. They've been working with 10 Democratic senators. As you saw last week, they went down to see the president, and there was no discussion of any linkage between infrastructure and the subsequent reconciliation package that the administration has in mind. In other words, they were discussed separately. The president walked out with the 20 bipartisan senators, announced they had an agreement, and a couple hours later said that if he got infrastructure without the second bill, he'd veto it. Then he walked that back. So let me just tell you where I think we are. I appreciate the president saying that he's willing to deal with infrastructure separately, but he doesn't control the Congress, and the Speaker and the Majority Leader of the Senate will determine the order. And so what I did this morning is to call on the President to ask the Majority Leader and the Speaker to deal with these issues separately, to deal with them separately. That's the way the deal was negotiated according to the 10 Republicans, I can assure you, who were in the discussion, there was no agreement that they would be linked. And so the president's promise to deal with it separately is nice, but isn't determinative unless the majority leader and the speaker agree.
That from Senator Mitch McConnell in Kentucky earlier today, and TheHill.com with more details, writing the following, quote, Democrats are pursuing a two-track infrastructure plan. On one track is the bipartisan deal that would cost approximately $1.2 trillion over 8 years, with more than $570 billion in new spending. On the second track is a sweeping multi-trillion dollar bill the Democrats plan to use under reconciliation, which allows them to bypass the 60-vote legislative filibuster. To unlock that option, Democrats will need all 50 members of their Senate caucus united so they can move without Republicans. Again, that story at TheHill.com. At the White House earlier today, Press Secretary Jen Psaki with this reaction.
The Senate Minority Leader put out a statement today at a news conference in which he said the president delinked the two bills. Does the White House take issue with that characterization, or do you agree with that? Is that what is happening?
I think the president is eager to sign both pieces of legislation into law, And he is going to focus his time and his effort on selling the benefits of these packages, what they would do for the American people, whether it's ensuring kids don't have lead in their drinking water or making sure families have additional benefit from the child tax credit extension. That's what his focus is going to be. In terms of the mechanics and the process, we're going to work closely with leaders in Congress, but he wanted to be clear that he did not intend to issue a veto threat, and he remains committed to moving that piece of legislation forward, just as he remains committed to moving the American Families Plan forward.
That from today's White House briefing. Meanwhile, in New York, Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg touring the more than 100-year-old rail tunnel that connects New York and New Jersey, offering White House support for what would be an $11 billion project to build a new tunnel that has endured years of funding disputes. Joining the Transportation Secretary, the Democratic Senate leader, Chuck Schumer of New York, and fellow Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, the tour included a ride through the 111-year-old span. If you've been in the area, you know it's the site of regular delays along a very busy rail corridor between New York, New Jersey, and Washington, D.C. More from Penn Station in New York with the Transportation Secretary and Senator Chuck Schumer.
It is no secret that the Trump administration maliciously and vindictively held back this tunnel, even though all of us had appropriated good money for the tunnel. But now, with a new president who's an Amtrak rider and a new secretary who understands the need for Gateway, it's all systems go. All systems go. One of the first things I mentioned to President-elect Biden was Gateway. He said he's on board. One of the first things I mentioned when he was first nominated to Secretary Buttigieg, probably the first thing, was Gateway, and he's all on board. So the bottom line is, we in the Senate and the House will be able to procure in the two Build Back Better bill, in the two bills we are doing, the traditional infrastructure bipartisan bill and in the budget reconciliation bill, the billions of dollars we need to build Gateway. And Secretary Buttigieg has pledged to remove all of the bureaucratic and other barriers. So once we allocate that money, once we appropriate that money, things will move very quickly. We have to. We have no choice but to move quickly.
The comments earlier in the day, Senator Chuck Schumer, Democratic leader, he was in New York City. So where do things stand this evening with the infrastructure debate? Joining us on the phone is Tyler Pager. He covers the White House for The Washington Post. A flurry of developments over the weekend. What's the latest?
Yeah, so at this point, I think the White House is optimistic that talks are back on track after the president had to somewhat walk back a comment he made last week where he basically threatened to veto the infrastructure deal that was negotiated as a compromise between Republicans and Democrats if the Democrats didn't also bring forward a much larger reconciliation bill. And so Biden put out a lengthy statement over the weekend, and Republicans seemingly have accepted that as good enough to continue to move forward. But again, there's a lot of hurdles that remain in the way as they try to put the framework into actual text of legislation to then get it passed through Congress.
You mentioned their support among Senate Republicans, but what about one key Republican, the Senate leader, Mitch McConnell of Kentucky?
Yeah, that remains one of the hurdles that Democrats and the Republicans who negotiated the compromise may have to contend with. Is McConnell has been quite critical of the comments that Biden and the Democratic leaders, Schumer and Pelosi, have made about pushing forward this reconciliation bill that includes a litany of wish list and priority items for Democrats, and saying that they should not link these two processes together. You know, it remains unclear at this point if McConnell is actually going to whip votes against it. Obviously, this is something many of his, members of his caucus have worked hard at, particularly someone like Senator Rob Portman, who's leaving the Senate after his term and kind of is a legacy, potential legacy item for him. So, it remains unclear if he's really going to stand in the way of this bill, but that remains an ongoing threat.
We're talking with Tyler Pager of The Washington Post. As you know, in 2020, this was a campaign pledge by candidate Joe Biden working across the aisle with Republicans. How much pressure is the president feeling to deliver on this infrastructure package with Republican support?
I think, you know, it seems that he was, you know, he was really committed to getting this done, and he kind of took a victory lap last week at the White House, celebrating that they had a deal and touting his ability and really, you know, saying, "I told you so," to all the critics and naysayers that said, you know, Washington is different now. It's not like when you were a senator and people struck deals. And I think he was really, and his staff were really validated by that. And so if they fall short and are unable to push this across the finish line, it will look like taking credit, you know, a premature victory and potentially embarrassing for the White House, who was so excited to tout this deal. So I think there is definitely some pressure there to, you know, see it through to the finish line.
And one final point is, you look at the debate in Congress among progressive Democrats calling for a much more robust plan, including that from Senator Bernie Sanders calling for $6 trillion, although other Senate Democrats like Joe Manchin saying that's too much money.
Right. That is the other, you know, side of the coin that they need to contend with, is keeping the progressives in line and happy to vote for the compromise bill, and then also figure out a way to placate them for their desires of a much bigger, more robust bill that includes, particularly on things related to climate change. The Sunrise Movement was protesting outside the White House about fears that climate would fall out of the bill. And so that is kind of the struggle that the Biden administration faces, is, you know, keeping the Republicans that agree to this framework in line to pass that bill while ensuring they get the Democratic votes for it, and then trying to find a path forward that satisfies the progressive wing of the party while also keeping Senators Joe Manchin, Kirsten Sinema, some of the more moderate Democrats in line as well.
More details tonight at WashingtonPost.com and in the newspaper. Tyler Pager, White House reporter, thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And now to Surfside, Florida, and the site of that horrific condo collapse last week. City officials saying that the cause remains unknown, but engineering reports, researchers, and residents have shed some light on the integrity of the structure as rescuers continue to find any possible survivors. The death toll is now confirmed at 10. 151 remain unaccounted for in the collapse of the Champlain Towers South. A report issued back in 2018 did raise some alarm bells. That engineering study detailed what it called significant cracks and breaks in the concrete. Engineering say it provided an estimate to make some extensive and necessary repairs to the condo association. The price tag 3 years ago was just over $9 million. CNN.com is reporting that a researcher says the condo showed signs of sinking as early as the 1990s. In addition, more recently, some of the residents raising concerns with the condo association over tremors during the construction of a nearby building, and local officials are now reviewing building protocols in the area. Florida Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz at the site and near the location with officials from NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, which, by the way, is part of the Commerce Department. More with Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
They will look through that preliminary investigation and determine whether they open a full investigation, and that is triggered when they get a sense of, after their preliminary review, of whether or not any decisions and fact-finding that they engage in as a result of that investigation can have longer-term implications and recommendations for how we change federal oversight, federal law, related to building construction and the kind of code enforcement decisions that will have to be made on the ground. So it's really important and very significant that they're here as early as they have been, because getting them here, embedded with the debris task force, making sure that they advise on how evidence should be preserved once law enforcement takes over, will give them a better chance of answering the question that I know I've been asked over and over, we all have been, you know, okay, how are we going to deal with the long-term implications of this? Did this only impact just this building? You know, we have, as we've said, you know, structures like this all the way up the coastline, all the way up the coastline of the United States. And what NIST will be able to help do is, they're a fact-finding, not a fault-finding agency, and a long-term investigation of theirs would give us a chance for me, as a member of Congress, to be able to to adopt changes in federal law that will help them make sure that when structures are built, that something like this could never happen again.
The Commerce Department, now part of that investigation, and those comments by Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who represents South Florida. On Friday, the city of Miami sending a letter urging buildings that are over six stories tall and more than 40 years old to get an immediate inspection from a qualified structural engineer. and the mayor of Boca Raton announcing that the city is creating more stringent standards for certifications of buildings following what happened in Surfside, Florida. In other news on this Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court today declining to hear a Virginia school board's appeal of a lower court ruling that allowed transgender students to use school bathrooms that correspond to their gender identity. It brings an end to the legal challenges involving Gavin Grimm, a trans student who sued the Gloucester County, Virginia High School back in 2015 after being denied access to the boys' restroom. Another story we're following is this headline from The Wall Street Journal. A costly new Alzheimer's drug could force Medicare to restrict access. It is a breakthrough drug that also has a number of lingering questions. And earlier today, I asked Wall Street Journal reporter Tom Burton about the drug and its price tag.
Well, it's called Aduhelm, and it costs about $56,000 a year. That's the list price. And in the drug world, amazingly enough, that's not astonishingly expensive on its own. The problem is that the drug may actually not work. The evidence on behalf of it working is pretty thin, number one. And number two, as a consequence, the drug might have to be taken, if at all, for a long period of time because it may not have very powerful effects. And then the thing that ultimately makes it really expensive is the fact that there are about 6 million people in the United States that have Alzheimer's in one degree or another. And that's a huge population. And when you take the huge population times a drug that may not work terribly well, and it may need to be taken, if at all, for a long period of time, you've got a really rough combination.
So based on that, Tom Burton, where does that put the Medicare debate and whether or not Medicare would even cover a drug like this?
Well, it's a little early to know for sure. There are some smart people who advise Medicare who say that it shouldn't pay for it at all, that the evidence on behalf of this drug working is so minimal that it does not make sense at this point for Medicare to pay for it. I think that that would be a fairly extreme position for them to take, although my job is not to predict the future. It's really to just sort of describe what's going on. There are other people who are smart who have either currently work in Medicare or have worked in Medicare who say that the best solution might be what's called a national coverage determination, which means that the agency would say, we will pay for this drug under the following circumstances. And one of the circumstances might be conducting what amounts to another clinical trial, but it would be a study in the real world of what happens to Medicare patients. When do their lab values improve? Do they stay out of the hospital, or do they end up in the hospital or the emergency room a lot because of the bleeding and brain swelling risks of this drug? So all of those real world measures are what some really smart people are suggesting that Medicare needs to do if it is going to pay for it.
And you mentioned 6 million. This really is part of the growing healthcare debate, as you point out in your piece at WallStreetJournal.com. Americans are living longer, and the rate of Alzheimer's will continue to increase over the next decade.
Well, that's right. And it's a horrible disease, as many people whose family members have live through it, as many of those people know. And so that's the dilemma. And in fact, that was kind of the dilemma that the FDA was dealing with. The evidence was not really strong. Some would argue that it was kind of non-existent, but I think it's fair to say the evidence was not very strong. But I think they made a decision, a good faith decision, based on compassion and based on wanting to try to find the first drug in about 20 years that may do anything at all to help Alzheimer's patients.
We will continue to follow the developments. Your work available online at WSJ.com. Tom Burton of The Wall Street Journal, we thank you for your time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow losing 150 points. The S&P, though, was up nearly 10, and some big gains for the NASDAQ climbing 140 points. Also, news on Facebook closing above the $1 trillion in market capitalization for the first time today. The social media company is the fifth U.S. company to hit that milestone, joining Apple, Microsoft, Amazon and the Google parent company Alphabet. The company's share rising today, in part because of a favorable legal ruling that dismissed an antitrust complaint brought on by the Federal Trade Commission in a number of states. Out west, the heat wave continues. Areas of the Pacific Northwest seeing their highest temperatures yet today. About 23 million people remain under the heat alerts, with temperatures surging 30 to 40 degrees above average. In Seattle, the high temperature today of 110 degrees. Portland, Oregon, setting a new record yesterday at 112. Canada with a new national record over the weekend at 116 degrees. But the National Weather Service saying a break into the weather could come as early as tomorrow. You're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back to Washington Today for this Monday. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your other headlines. Former New Jersey governor and former presidential candidate Chris Christie out with a new book this fall. Its title, Republican Rescue, Saving the Party from Truth Deniers, Conspiracy Theorists, and the Dangerous Policies of Joe Biden. The book is being published by Threshold Editions, part of Simon & Schuster. It will be released on November 16th. And the House Ethics Committee today upholding a $5,000 fine against Pennsylvania Congressman Lloyd Smucker for failing to complete a security screening before entering the House chamber. The lawmaker is the third House Republican whose appeal against paying the fine has been rejected by the committee. The two other Republicans, Louie Gohmert of Texas, Andrew Clyde of Georgia, filing a lawsuit earlier this month challenging the constitutionality of using fines to enforce compliance with metal detectors installed outside the House chamber after the insurrection on January the 6th. In other news, the Pentagon today releasing footage of those U.S. airstrikes in Iraq and Syria against facilities used by the Iran-backed militia groups. The weekend developments could potentially affect the diplomatic overtures surrounding the revival of the 2015 Iranian nuclear deal. The White House announcing yesterday that the defensive precision airstrikes targeting those weapon storage facilities in Syria and other locations in Iran, Iraq's military issuing a rare condemnation calling the U.S. strikes, quote, a blatant and unacceptable violation of Iraqi sovereignty and national security, during a meeting with the Israeli president, President Joe Biden, with these remarks.
Well, I'm really happy to have President Rivlin here, and it's not technically appropriate, but I'm so delighted his daughter is here. She's in the back right there. I got to meet her and talk about our kids and grandkids and all the like. And anyway, I just want to thank the president for being here and for your dedication to strengthening the relationship between the United States and Israel. Thank you. And as the American press here can tell you, my commitment to Israel is, well, they can't tell you anything, actually, they're not supposed to, but it's ironclad. It's real. It's something that I often say, if it weren't easy, we'd have to invent one. And this includes, we're committed to unwavering commitment to your self-defense. And today we're going to be discussing a broad range of challenges, including Iran. What I can say to you, Iran will never get a nuclear weapon on my watch, as they say. I directed last night's airstrikes targeting sites used by the Iranian-backed militia group responsible for recent attacks on U.S. personnel in Iraq. And I have that authority under Article 2, and even those up in the Hill who are reluctant to acknowledge that have acknowledged that's the case. I also want to be clear that, as I said, my team and I are already working closely with the Israeli government that took office earlier this month. I'm looking forward to hosting Prime Minister Bennett at the White House very soon. And the U.S. fully supports normalization of the relationship between Israel and Middle Eastern countries that you're making some headway on, and Africa as well, and beyond the important progress. We are really looking forward to building back a wider block of peace and stability. And going forward, Mr. President, the United States and Israel are going to continue to work together to advance peace in the region and stability. And I have only one regret. You're leaving as president, but not immediately, not soon.
7 years for Israelis is enough. For the Americans, 8 years could be a little bit longer, but for the Israelis, 7 years, it's enough.
Well, welcome.
It's good to be president, I must say. Yeah.
That from the Oval Office with the Israeli president and President Joe Biden. He made comments about the weekend airstrikes. Reaction to those airstrikes on Capitol Hill, first from Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, issuing a statement that reads in part, quote, "The danger here is that you fall into a pattern of military escalation that becomes war without voters ever having a say." But Oklahoma Senator Jim Inhofe, who is the top Republican on the Senate Armed Services Committee, saying the president did the right thing and highlights the need to keep the 2002 Iraq War authorization, known as AUMF, on the books. Meanwhile, retired Army General and former CIA Director General David Petraeus was asked about the weekend airstrikes. He did so during a conversation sponsored by WashingtonPost.com.
Well, I do support this, and I do believe that this is a problem, which is why these strikes were taken. These Iranian-supported Shia militia that have been a huge problem over the last two decades, we defeated them, as you will recall, in the second half of the second year of the surge in the battles of Sadr, Sidi, and Basra, and others. But they were allowed to reassemble and get back on the streets when the threat of ISIS loomed large in Iraq, and they have never left the streets since then and are now much more heavily equipped and armed with weapons provided by Iran. And they have been shooting rockets and mortars and flying drones at our forces. Only a few thousand of them left there in a variety of bases around the country, including in the Kurdish region where they've been struck. And so this had to happen, I think. The question is, does this exacerbate the presence of the U.S. forces for the Iraqi government that doesn't like the Iranian supported militia, but they are a reality and they are literally part of the overall forces of Iraq. In fact, there was just a huge parade of them in honor of them and what they had done. So that's the political dynamic of this. And we have to be very careful not to stress that over much, which is undoubtedly one reason that probably two of the strikes were in Syria and just one of them in Iraq. And it may be that there have to be some other asymmetric attacks against various assets in the Gulf or in Iran, where it's not completely clear who did what was done, but the Iranians will have a sense that we were behind it and that they should not allow their militia. They do largely control these militia and can direct them, and they're going to have to put a leash on them. And then the challenge is going to be for the Iraqi government, that, as I said, does not love these elements at all, but did employ them, and they did fight hard against the Islamic State. They are a reality, and they're linked to political parties, because keep in mind what Iran has always sought to do in Iraq is what they have achieved in Lebanon, which is to have strong forces on the ground, Lebanese Hezbollah militia forces, that have street muscle, and then to have corresponding political power in the parliament, the Iraqi Council of Representatives. So in other words, to Lebanonize Iraq, just as they have Lebanonized Iran. They're not quite at that level yet in the parliament. There are some very important Shia elements that swing back and forth between the government and the Iranian-supported desires. But that's the reality that a very competent prime minister and president and other ministers are dealing with in Iraq, with an election probable later this year.
Retired General David Petraeus, he made his comments at an event sponsored by The Washington Post. Joining us on the phone is Andrew Desiderio, who is following the story and what it means for the congressional debate over AUMF. Thanks for being with us, and tell us the latest, the impact that these airstrikes might have on that debate.
Well, look, as you know, Steve, the House recently repealed the 2002 Iraq War authorization, and the Senate will soon follow suit. But, you know, this particular issue is not as relevant to those existing war authorizations simply because President Biden did not claim those as legal justification for these airstrikes, right? He claimed his Article II powers, his Article II authority for self-defense because, as the Pentagon explained in their statement last night, these Iran-backed militia groups were attacking Americans in the region, and the president thought that he had, the responsibility to strike back against them. So that has sort of raised the stakes of the AUMF debate in that, you know, the president doesn't just rely on authorizations from Congress to carry out his mission, that it, you know, he also relies on his Article II powers under the Constitution. And that's something that a lot of Democrats think they need to address and rein in somehow.
But there does seem to be growing support within the Senate to repeal AUMF, led by Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia.
That's right. So when the Senate returns from its two-week recess, this Foreign Relations Committee is going to mark up a repeal of the 1991 and 2002 authorizations for the use of military force in Iraq. That bill has a Republican co-sponsor in Todd Young of Indiana. It's expected to easily pass the Foreign Relations Committee. It will be a little bit of an uphill climb on the Senate floor in terms of getting the 60 votes. But it seems, based on my whip count, that it would be feasible to say that enough Republicans would support repealing those two outdated war authorizations, especially because many of them on the record have acknowledged over the years that Congress should be clawing back some of its authority over the power to make war.
Let's turn our attention to the Sunday airstrikes. What was the mission of the strike, the intended target, and did the Pentagon meet its goals?
Well, the Pentagon says it did meet its goals. They said it was a defensive measure. They said it was a precision airstrike targeted against these weapons facilities that were owned and operated by these militia groups that are supported by the Iranian government and have been attacking Americans and American interests along the Iraq-Syria border. That is obviously still a very fraught part of the world right now. The U.S. is still heavily involved in both countries, despite these efforts that are underway in Congress to remove the president's ability to carry out military operations there, which is, of course, why the president relied on his Article II authority, as I mentioned before, rather than claiming a previous authorization that might already be on the books, as Congress is actually trying to get those off the books. And the president says he supports that effort.
And, of course, all of this coming at a difficult time. You mentioned in your piece, which is available at Politico.com, the administration trying to deal with the Iraqi government and also, in a way, trying to restart negotiations with Tehran on that nuclear deal.
Yeah, so that's going to be sort of the longer-term goal for President Biden here, is that he has said he wants to get back into the Iran nuclear deal, but that the conditions have to be right and that both countries, both the U.S. and Iran, that is, has to be willing to compromise and to give things up. For the U.S., that would likely mean lifting all these economic sanctions on the Iranian government and Iranian businesses that were put into place under former President Trump under what he called his maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Of course, in 2018, it was President Trump who took the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal. That was a move that was supported by nearly all Republicans, and a few Democrats supported it too. But President Biden has a very different policy goal in mind right now, and he has dispatched some of his negotiators to Vienna, where they have been indirectly negotiating with the Iranians to try to get back into this nuclear deal to, you know, at least piece it together.
Politico's Andrew Desiderio joining us here in Washington. As always, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Steve.
Meanwhile, another part of this debate, Virginia Democratic Representative Abigail Spanberger, who is a former CIA official, saying she has not read the administration's justification for the airstrike yet, but in an interview, she said she does not foresee the move to spur a protracted war powers debate. However, on the House floor earlier today, she did make these remarks on an earlier AUMF dating back to 1991.
While the Constitution is clear, only Congress can declare war, we have steadily surrendered this responsibility to the executive branch. Building off the House's vote earlier this month to repeal the 2002 AUMF, we are considering today two additional bipartisan bills that repeal other outdated and inactive AUMFs. First, we're considering my legislation to repeal the 1991 AUMF against Iraq. This AUMF was Congress's authorization for the first Gulf War of 1991 in response to Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait 30 years ago. The short military conflict that took place under this authority has been over for three decades, and we must remove this old, inactive authority from the books. Repealing this AUMF would help ensure that it is not misused or stretched by any American president going forward.
That from Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, Democrat from Virginia, on the House floor earlier today. And by the way, we take a deep dive on the AUMF debate on our podcast, The Weekly. You can listen and follow wherever you get your favorite podcast. Earlier today, Speaker Nancy Pelosi introducing H.R. 503. It establishes the Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. We're told that the Rules Committee will report this bill out tonight, scheduled for floor debate on Wednesday. And according to an aide to Speaker Pelosi, she is reportedly considering the appointment of a Republican, one of eight appointments she would make for this Select Committee. Secretary of State Tony Blinken in Rome today, in part to meet with Pope Francis at the Vatican, who expressed what he described as, quote, his affection for the American people, the two meeting for about 40 minutes. And the Secretary of State also meeting with his counterpart in Italy, the Italian foreign minister, during a joint news conference. Secretary Blinken was asked about a campaign by some American bishops to deny Holy Communion to Roman Catholic politicians, including President Biden, because of their support for abortion rights.
On your meeting earlier today with Pope Francis, were there any discussions of President Biden receiving Holy Communion? And on coronavirus, Pope Francis has assessed that those who refuse to get the COVID-19 vaccine are suicidal. Do you agree?
With regard to the meeting with His Holiness the Pope, let me just say, on a personal level, what an honor it was. The meeting was extremely warm and very wide-ranging. We covered a lot of ground, and I certainly don't want to speak for His Holiness, but just speaking for myself and speaking for the United States, I was very gratified by the meeting and gratified as well by the strong leadership of His Holiness on the pandemic, on climate change, on the challenge that we have to address when it comes to irregular migration and refugees, and more broadly, and maybe most important of all, his leadership on the basic proposition that we have to stand for human dignity in everything we do to the best of our ability. One of the luxuries of my job is that I don't do domestic politics. And so I'll simply say that it was truly a wonderful and memorable moment to have had the opportunity to speak to His Holiness and to have such a warm and wide-ranging conversation.
And can I just follow up? Do you agree with Pope Francis's assessment that those who refuse the COVID-19 vaccine are engaging in a suicidal effort?
I'm not going to speak for the Pope in any way. I think we strongly believe in the importance of vaccination, of seeing as many people, not just in our own countries, but around the world, get vaccinated, and to do so as quickly as possible. And of course, one of the reasons that we came together at the G7 to push 1 billion vaccine doses out around the world is because of the absolute importance of this initiative and the need to be vaccinated. Look, here is the reality that we're faced with. As long as the virus is replicating somewhere, it's likely to be mutating. And as long as it's mutating, there is the distinct possibility that it comes back and bites even those who have been vaccinated. So we have to get ahead of this. And the way to get ahead of this is with the fastest possible vaccination around the world. That's why Italy and the United States are working so closely together to make sure that we get vaccines out there.
That from the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken. He was in France over the weekend and in Rome, also at the Vatican, meeting with Pope Francis. Finally, a note on the passing of former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel. He served two terms, 1969 through 1981, making a name for himself early in his first term when he read the Pentagon Papers into the congressional record back in 1971. He ran for president in 2008, and during a C-SPAN interview, he talked about the Pentagon Papers.
When you mentioned the Pentagon Papers, that Richard Nixon sued me all the way to the Supreme Court. That decision essentially said that I, as a senator, could release any information to the American people that I felt necessary under the speech and debate clause of the Constitution. Well, that is just as inviolable today as it was then. And when George Bush was cooking the intelligence books, and they're cooking them now with respect to Iran, that some member of Congress ought to have the guts to step forward and say, hey, this is wrong. What they're doing is wrong, and begin to tell the American people the truth. We have levels of secrecy in our government that are appalling. I would venture to say, right away, almost 80% of what the government holds secret should not be held secret, and a democracy can only survive if the people are knowledgeable about what their government is doing. How can they react if they don't know what the leaders are doing?
That from the C-SPAN Video Library, former Senator Mike Gravel in a 2007 interview. He passed away over the weekend. The former Alaska senator was 91 years old. A reminder, this program, Washington Today, is available as a podcast. Be sure to listen and follow wherever you get your favorite podcast, and all of our coverage available on the web at cspan.org. I'm Steve Scully with the Monday edition, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.